Thrive with Asperger's, episode number 20. Hello and welcome to this episode of Thrive with Asperger's. My name is Steve Borgman and this is the podcast dedicated to the Asperger's autism community. My goal is to help you find the encouragement, tips, and inspiration to help you live your life to the fullest. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Eva Mendez. She is a psychotherapist, couples counselor, and author, speaker, specializing in Asperger's, autism spectrum, ADD and learning differences, multicultural issues, and neurodiversity. We'll be learning how she found her calling and her thoughts and tips for neurodiverse couples. This podcast is brought to you by the Thrive with Asperger's community, a closed Facebook group for helping you connect with others from the Autism Asperger's community. Just go to myaspergers.net/community to join. And now on to our interview. I'm very excited today to welcome Eva Mendez to our show. Eva, I discovered while talking to Leanne Holiday, and she mentioned Eva as one of her favorite marriage counselors for couples on the autism spectrum. And Eva has written a book called Marriage and Lasting Relationships with Asperger's Syndrome. As I'm on her website here at evmendes.com. I read that she is a skilled and experienced couples counselor working with couples where one or both partners have Asperger's syndrome and are on the autism spectrum, either diagnosed or undiagnosed. She works with adults, high-functioning autism, ADHD, nonverbal learning disability, and a whole bunch of other alphabet soup letters. She also works with women with Asperger's syndrome. She's originally from Mumbai, India, and Eva is very active with the Asperger Autism Network. She runs groups, gives presentations, and so I'm very excited to have her on. And I was talking to her before we started how excited I am to have her because I get so many inquiries from people all over the country wanting help with their marriage. And I have so few people to refer them to out here. Eva can be a resource to you. And we'll hear more about that later on. First of all, just say welcome, Eva.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's really good being with you on the show.
Thank you. Eva, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself? Of course, I just gave a little bit of an introduction, but can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you came to work with adults with Asperger's autism?
Yeah, so a little bit about myself. I guess I had a career in graphic design prior to this, but then was getting very interested in the area of couples counseling and counseling in general. So in grad school, my studies were focused on couples counseling. And then after that, you know, I kind of was looking for a new area to focus on and got very interested in neurology and the human brain. I'm sort of like a geek, so not your average therapist, I suppose, because I don't think that sort of thing tends to interest maybe most therapists. Some kind of a scientific mindset. So one of my professors in his lectures on ADHD also mentioned Asperger's and said something like half of that MIT campus probably has Asperger's, which piqued my curiosity as MIT is just down the street from where I live. And I've had many friends and acquaintances who've studied there and been there a lot. So then I was looking for an internship and I decided to, you know, just Google Asperger's and things like that. And the Asperger Autism Network, they were formerly known as the Asperger's Association of New England, they came up. And I just kind of called them. The funny thing is I wasn't even really looking, I didn't look around that much for internships. I think it was just meant to be. And I met with the executive director, Danya Jekyll, and was immediately invited on board. And that was in October of 2009. And ever since then, I've worked with adults with ASD. So it was just like this mystical kind of thing that happened. And I love it.
It's great to hear that it was a good fit, not only when you first heard about it, you were intrigued about it from the scientific standpoint, but then to actually meet people. But I'm just curious, what was it like to actually meet Aspergians?
Look, say use a lot of different terms, Aspergians, Aspies, adults with ASD. I think I still remember the first time I walked into the A&E offices. And I just felt like this calm sort of overcome me. And I was just like, wow, I love the energy here. And then when I met adults and, you know, even the people who run the place and the adults, it just felt at home. And I think eventually I realized why that was, because I think a number of people in my family are probably on the spectrum. So I think I just have a natural sort of affinity for it, and I probably grew up with a lot of these high functioning adults in my family. So yeah, it just felt very natural. I just loved them. It was great.
It's really neat when your calling comes to you like that. You know, here you are just sitting one day in class listening to lectures on neurology. You hear about Asperger's, you look up a chapter, and there you are. So it's great to hear about that. And believe me, we need you.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your background and experience. I saw on your resume that you were a disability counselor at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. What was some of your work involved with there?
That was also another fortunate turn of events. So in the Boston area, it's a small but really robust ASD community. So people do sort of know each other. So one of the professors there, Dr. Ashley Hillier, who's done a lot of research and published a lot of work with adults with ASD, he actually contacted me saying, hey, you know, we're looking for somebody who has this kind of experience. And then I said, well, I could, you know, pick up a few hours. So I ended up actually going and speaking to the director of disability services, and right away I was recruited. I don't even think the job was posted at the time. They didn't even bother posting it, and it just happened. You know, the offer was in my mailbox, in my inbox before I even got home. So it was fantastic. And to work on a campus is just a special sort of a joy. UMass Lowell is very renowned as a very good engineering school. And so they also have a strong music and arts program as well. So in addition to that, it's a state school. So it has a reasonable tuition, you know, relatively speaking. And it's also a commuter school. In fact, they didn't have students living on campus until a few years ago. So because of all those reasons, a lot of students who struggle to live away from home were attracted to this campus, but who were also interested in engineering and things like that. So, and they have some world-class programs, their music program, their plastics engineering program. It's really like world-class. And then, of course, even at my interview, right, I had to walk through North Campus, and North Campus is the engineering campus. So as I'm like finding my way to the disability service office, I'm walking through like the chemistry labs and these, you know, mechanical materials labs and things like that. So I was like, okay, this also feels kind of strangely familiar. And the professors, probably a lot of them on the spectrum themselves and things like that. So I really just loved it there. So what I worked there, a lot with students coming out of high school into college. And it was such an amazing experience because we would see hundreds of these neuropsychological evaluation and IEPs and 504 plans, because they would come in with these accommodations. So it gave me, because I don't work with, you know, little kids, it really kind of gave me an insight into their history. Like starting from a younger age and all their test scores and their neuropsychological profile. And so then I was really trained, you know, after you see a few hundreds of these, they start looking familiar. And so these students didn't just have the ASD diagnosis. Some of them had a lot of them had ADHD, learning differences, you know, most of the disabilities that we saw in the disabilities department were neurological in nature. They weren't so, like, the physical disabilities we saw less of. We, because it's a state school, we also saw a lot of veterans with brain trauma, traumatic brain injury, that sort of thing. So it was really wonderful because I got a chance to see, well, okay, how does a student with a traumatic brain injury and autism differ? But there are some similarities maybe, and ADHD, and look at their neurological profile. And then also see where maybe there was the differential diagnosis, but also a lot of students with ASD were misdiagnosed. I felt like a lot of them had an ADHD diagnosis. And then I would see the classic ADHD guys, you know. So it was just a great sort of an environment, you know, of, I don't know, just kind of working with these students and the sheer numbers of it. So we would be inundated. Even in the summer months, because the summer months we're getting the paperwork, so the for enrollments, you know, and then come July and August, we were doing a lot of intakes, and then in August we would have this thing called the transition seminar. So we would orient these students. So we would have a separate orientation just for students who are registered with our department to take them on around campus to show them sort of the ropes of what it means to be a student and all of that. So that was really fantastic. And then I also ran a group, a research group, actually, with Dr. Hillier. So she would, it was a one-way mirror, so I would be leading the group. Sometimes I had a co-leader, sometimes I didn't. For students on the spectrum, we had, it was a six-week group, and there was a curriculum for each group. So we addressed mainly campus-related issues, like making friends, academic challenges, romantic relationships, joining extracurricular activities. When the professor assigns you to work in groups, what does that mean? A lot of our students on the spectrum would really struggle with that sort of thing. So we really tried to break it down, but also have a place for them to have a support group. So that was really wonderful, and Dr. Hillier collected a lot of data, and we even, I think, had a poster at a conference or something, and hopefully she's going to have enough data soon to publish too, you know, so yeah.
I think that would be an extremely valuable book, because the whole topic of college and ASD, I think it's catching up slowly, but I think there's a lot of work to do still.
Yeah, and there is a, for your listeners, there is a book, I forget what exactly it's called, but by Lorraine Wolf and Jane Thierfield. If anybody's interested, they can just shoot me an email. I'll be happy to, you know. So there are some books that are now out. So, yeah.
Well, even better, I'm going to do one better for my audience, and that is I will get in touch with you, and if I can get a list of those, I'll put those in the show notes.
Thank you. That would be fantastic. Yeah, that would be great.
What a great background, though, and what great experience. Now, how many years were you there in that position?
So I was there for roughly about 2 years, not very long. Things sort of moved pretty quickly for my career. Yeah, so about 2 years, and hopefully we'll collaborate again. Dr. Hillier and I are looking to collaborate again on a study on sexuality and adults on the spectrum. So we'll see how that goes.
Another big topic and a big need. Since we're on your career trajectory, where did you go after you were a disability counselor at the University of Massachusetts? What was your next step after that?
So my next step after that was I actually got licensed, independently licensed, and then I actually ended up opening my own practice. And I did that, you know, I never thought I would be in practice for myself, because the thought of being self-employed was just freaky, you know. But I found that nobody was doing the work that I wanted to do. So I felt like I couldn't really be employed, so I had to create it. So that's how that came about. And everything just fell into place. I first was using some space at A&E, and they were, you know, I was bartering services for them and kind of working in partnership with them. And I still do the groups there. And then I found a great office space here in Arlington in Massachusetts, and it's about 6 miles outside of Boston. So it's very accessible. You know, if people are coming from out of town to see me from Logan Airport or students who are, you know, around, there's public transportation. So it's fantastic. It was a great benefit. Yeah.
What are some of your favorite parts about your work, and what are some of your favorite focuses, with individuals on the autism spectrum?
Thank you for asking that question. That's great. So my favorite parts are just last week I had a young woman who came out to me as being asexual and agender, which is you know, a new kind of thing on the LGBTQA spectrum, and she also is on the autism spectrum. And she said that, and this was only our second session, and she said that she had never, she hadn't been able to come out even to her parents. She hadn't told other than a couple of her friends that that's how she saw herself. And she got so excited that, you know, she wanted to give me a hug, and I think we settled for a handshake. But that was like so wonderful, and she kept thanking me, and I was like so happy to have been there for her. And yeah, so many times I once remember I was doing like a sliding scale for this couple that I was seeing, and they were both autistic, and they both had a lot of financial struggles. So I gave them a reduced fee, and then one day they came in with this envelope full of cash. And they said, well, we looked at our bank account and we did the math and we realized we could actually pay you your full fee. And I just felt like someone had just given me like a box full of diamonds or like all the wealth in the world. And I said to them, no, thank you. We agreed upon the fee and we're that, you know, I'm good. But thank you for thinking of me. And it was like the best story ever, I think, that I could ever, you know, have. And it just makes my day. It makes me feel like you said, you know, we need you. Well, I need people on the spectrum too, because I feel like otherwise my life wouldn't have the meaning and focus that it has. So I'm so deeply grateful.
I have to agree with you 100%. As a therapist myself, and I also specialize with working with individuals on the spectrum, I have received so much more than they probably have. Just the people that I interact with online or at my practice, it's for all of you listening, you are some wonderful people out there. And as you all know, there's a lot of, that us that we who are not on the spectrum need to learn from you. So both Eva and I thank all of you. This brings me to another question, and that is, why do you think that adult autism spectrum or Asperger's has received so little attention up to this point?
Yeah, let me actually get to that question. I just remembered I didn't answer your earlier question about what my focus is. So my current focuses are other than couples, that's a big part of my practice. I also see young adults who are sort of the parents are trying to transition them out of the household. They're getting transitioned into college. They go to college, but they don't have a social life. They want a girlfriend or a boyfriend or you know, a mate. So there's that. Some of the young adults, they're past college and now they're looking for jobs. They don't know what to do. They're still struggling to find their place in the world. I have a fair amount of women that I see. I also see a fair amount of LGBTQA folks. That's kind of also kind of increasing in number now. And then I'm also getting a lot of requests to see younger people. So my youngest was like a 14-year-old. And I might even end up seeing, I usually don't like to diversify my focus too much, but I'll make special exceptions here and there. And then I also work a lot remotely with people. So I work, my furthest couple is in India, actually, in Mumbai. So I Skype with them. And I have clients in California, Canada, England, even Australia. So, and I'm supervising somebody now in Mexico City, Mexico. And she's running groups there. So my other focus right now is also hoping to train clinicians as well, so that you know, I just did a 4-hour workshop last 2 weekends ago, at our professional organization here for licensed mental health counselors. So that's all of that is my focus.
That's a great focus, because not only are you reaching the people in your community, but you're having an impact around the world, number one. Number two, you're training people who can impact beyond you.
Yes.
That must be very rewarding.
Yes, absolutely.
And now I'll transition over to...
Yes, though why do you think adults have received so little attention? And do I see this changing? I think partly is, you know, you probably are familiar with the Leo Kanner versus Hans Asperger story.
Can you please go into detail for those of us who may not be as familiar?
Okay, so basically, I mean, just in a nutshell, you know, I can geek out on it, but I won't.
Please do.
So historically, I think in the United States, it was like Leo Kanner, you know, he was a psychiatrist. And his focus was more on like classical autism. And then Hans Asperger, who was in Austria, you know, this was all around like World War II and stuff. So he was writing and seeing, he was a pediatrician and like a medical theorist and a professor probably too. So he was kind of looking at these, you know, what he called little professors, these children who were very highly gifted. In fact, I think one of his patients went on to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. So he had these very extremely high functioning children and adults, you know, who could talk a lot about their special interest and things like that. So I think for some reason, you know, maybe because of the Second World War, and also because I think the field of psychology can be somewhat trend based, you know, I think that's we can have a criticism that it should be more scientifically based, you know, in that sense. I think we can agree on that. And I think that's changing with the research and, you know, measurable, outcomes that we're being forced now to do because of health insurance and the way the field is moving anyway. So I think that will maybe come more, you know, in time. So I think Kanner's work, which was on the low end of the spectrum, was well known. So a lot of people didn't, so it was like the Rain Man kind of, you know, if you thought of somebody who was autistic, but sort of high functioning, you would think of the, like the idiot savant kind of person, you know? And then I think, you'd have to be pretty visibly impaired to get like a Asperger's or autism kind of diagnosis. So then the focus was more towards the kids. And then 1994, we had, you know, Asperger's syndrome became the official diagnosis. So it took a while. Like Great Britain, you know, they had Uta Frith and Lorna Wing and, you know, Tony Atwood and stuff. So they were sort of somehow more ahead of America, I think, in not only in autism, maybe in all developmental disabilities. So, you know, and maybe Americans are more accepting of quirky people. I don't know. But maybe in England you stick out. I don't know. There could be all kinds of things. And then also, I think the whole, you know, the dot-com kind of taking off, you know, and now we have more and more people in the software industries, Silicon Valley here, in Boston, you know, biotech and all these things. So these people are, I think, increasing in number. Who knows what's going on? Or maybe they were already around, you know. And now I think a lot of their kids were being diagnosed with Asperger's and ADHD and OCD and all these. And if you were a high functioning adult, you ended up getting the, you know this, you know, anxiety, depression, ADHD, OCD, even maybe personality disorders sometimes, those kinds of diagnoses. So the adults, because clinicians also, I mean, it's not our fault. We weren't trained. Like even in grad school, I had one chapter on Asperger's, you know, and it's not enough because it's such a complex thing. And you really do need a specialist. But the more, even if I think these days we train clinicians who aren't specialists to identify, well, what are the traits and all that. And the more it's permeating, I think, the media, you know, with the TV shows and with movies and popular books and things like that. I recently went to see the Broadway play of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. And that's great, you know. So the more it enters people's consciousness, I think we'll now be able to recognize. And a lot of adults with Asperger's may not even need a diagnosis until maybe they end up with a traumatic event or some kind of situation that they can no longer cope with. Because of their high IQs, many of them would say that they're smarter than the therapist, or that talk therapy doesn't work for them. Or they want really concrete solutions. So now I think, you know, they themselves are being able to identify, well, I work this way, and clinicians are also learning more. So I think hopefully it's changing, you know, but we can't do enough of what we're doing right now. More and more awareness needs to happen.
Right. And that's why I'm so glad you're on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eva, can you tell us your thoughts on, now that Asperger's has kind of been enveloped under the larger umbrella of autism, how have your clients and how are the professional community around you, how have you all coped with that?
For me, I think maybe I'm a little bit insulated from that change, perhaps. You know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe 5 years down the road, we'd have a better gauge of how it's really affecting people. And then also the title of my book, you know, it has Asperger's syndrome in it. And then in parens, it says autism spectrum disorders. And I actually wanted to put autism spectrum differences, which is what I talk about in the book as terminology, because I don't like the word disorder. But that's the publisher's thing. And, you know, we need people to identify it and all that. So I think, you know, Dr. Dan Rosen, who's in the Massachusetts area here, and he's a specialist. I mean, he's still, I think, he's sort of one of the people I look at as like a lead, you know, in terms of how he thinks about labels and Asperger's versus ASD and stuff. And he, I think on his diagnoses, he puts down maybe ASD level 1 maybe is Asperger's, you know, and then he maybe puts down the word Asperger syndrome 2. When I do diagnoses letters and things like that for my clients, I do the same thing. So I mean, I haven't seen it affect my practice a whole lot, and maybe also because with the couples work, you know, the spouses are looking, and then a lot of the times the woman with Asperger's are looking too. And some of the kids that are, because I also see adults, they may have already had the Asperger diagnosis and had that word in their consciousness all along growing up, you know? And then some of the adults that I work with have fully embraced the autism language and say, I'm autistic. You know, so everybody is, you know, just a little bit different in that. So far, I feel like it hasn't touched me yet. Like I haven't, you know, yeah.
Okay. Eva, I want to focus next on relationships, whether it be marriage or whether it be romantic partnerships. This is such a huge need, and I get asked so many different questions about this. Can you tell me what are some of the biggest challenges that you see? I'm going to start off with mixed couples, meaning one person is quote neurotypical, whatever that means, and the other person is Asperger's or autism spectrum. What do you see as some of the biggest, most frequent challenges that bring the couples in to see you?
In my book, actually, I don't use the word neurotypical. I use non-spectrum.
Thank you.
Because, you know, sometimes just because somebody is not on the spectrum doesn't mean they're neurotypical. A lot of the spouses I see who are not on the spectrum might have ADHD themselves, or they might have some other neurological thing going on, or even anxiety and depression. It's not a neurological difference, but I think it affects people.
That's a very helpful distinction, actually, because I've often struggled with, what do I use other than neurotypical?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't like the word, because it just is like, oh, that's neurotypical.
Yeah, like we're the neurotypicals and you're the spectrumites.
Yeah, exactly. So I just feel like, yeah, like, you know, non-spectrum, but doesn't mean that somebody couldn't have something else that's neurologically different, you know?
I like that.
In the reason I wrote my book, I think, because it came out of my paper, like I said, before we started the podcast interview, was it came out of my paper, Marriage with Asperger's Syndrome, 14 Practical Strategies. And that's available on my website. So that basically has, I think, all the 14 elements. And now in my book, there are even more of them, of what are the common themes that come up with the mixed marriages, like you say. So just to quickly rattle some off, I think the first one is diagnosis. That's a big piece that couples really struggle with. So do they get an official diagnosis? Where do they get one? Is one needed? Who can do one? What does it mean? All of that. So I kind of demystify a lot of that in my book, because I had not read a single anything, not even a paper on this, article or book on just how to demystify the diagnosis piece. And I felt like I really needed to do that. Then the other part is kind of learning about ASD and understanding, especially for the non-spectrum partner, so that they don't think that their partner is deliberately or willfully hurting them, that this is a neurological difference. And then sometimes what I find that happens is the partner with ASD, they are very intellectually capable. So they may say in the session, yeah, I do want to meet your needs. I do want to do this and apply these strategies. But then it's like, how much can they do and how fast? And then what can we expect? What kind of progress can you see? Just because they understand that they have ASD, that doesn't mean that they're going to now all of a sudden have this accelerated growth pace and turn into a non-spectrum person. So there's a lot of like adjusting expectations. And what does that difference really mean? That neurological difference, really breaking it down, I think, for both partners, because both partners can be frustrated on that. Then it's also learning to manage all the comorbid mental health conditions. I have, anxiety, put in my book, I have anxiety, depression, OCD, ADHD. And I also put anger in the same chapter, because anger to me is, it's a mental health condition maybe for all people, but it's particularly when pertaining to people with Asperger's, or ASD. Then emotional intelligence and theory of mind.
Can I back up just a little bit? Because that one caught my ear. Can you tell me a little bit more why you feel that anger specifically is almost a separate thing in itself for individuals on the spectrum?
So what I see a lot is that because of the high logic and high IQ and high intelligence, people with Asperger's are very much in their head. And they can make them very arrogant, actually. So I often say to my clients, anger and arrogance are two sides of the same coin. So when we get angry at someone, we have sort of like, we're like, oh, why can't they? Because we think we're better or something. And so they do have anger. Sometimes it's a lack, like the neurological roots of that anger is the sort of challenges that adults have with emotional regulation. So I think it's their amygdala is a bit larger. That's what I've heard from some of these research lectures I've sat in. So then it's less, which is, it's larger than average, I suppose. So then it affects their ability to be able to regulate their moods.
Does that mean that the emotional states can be experienced more strongly then?
Yeah, very extreme. And then they can go from 0 to 60 with the anger, which can traumatize the non-spectrum partner. I think that's a really big problem. And it's very traumatizing because all of a sudden this person is so angry and it's a meltdown, and then it just passes. And the other person, the non-spectrum partner, is reeling from it. And the person with ASD has sort of moved on, and they're kind of going, okay, well, can we watch TV or do something fun or whatever? And the partner is going, no, we just had a big blowout and you terrorized me and all of this stuff, So I think it's a huge thing. And luckily, I think, I'm not a doctor, but some low forms of low doses of antidepressants and stuff can really help to help regulate the mood and like increase the bandwidth. And then a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness practices. I use a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy types of techniques in my practice. Mindfulness, I give a lot of homework for meditation and things like that. Do exercising a lot, any kind of form, of that, to get them in touch with their bodies, and then so that they don't go so quickly with the anger. You know, they don't just go from 0 to 60 and then it's all over. You know, there's this big nuclear reaction and then it's all over. That's what one of my couples says.
I'm thinking about people in my audience, and I would like you to speak. I want to focus on hope. So many of the couples that I talk to, they're just worn out and they're hopeless. So yes. Could you give one word of hope and maybe one tip to a non-autism spouse who just feels like, how in the world are we ever going to make it through this marriage or relationship?
Thank you. That's a really good question. So one thing I say is to staying motivated is chapter 16 in my book.
There's a nice.
There's a whole chapter on it because it is a problem and I recognize it. I think self-care, putting yourself first, you really have to, because David Finch, I think, who you interviewed, he at a conference said, somebody with in a relationship with someone with special needs also has special needs. I love that quote, and he's right. So if you're married to somebody with special needs, you have special needs. So I think really prioritizing that. And my grad school professor, actually the one who introduced me to Asperger's, would often have a saying he would say about our thesis. He would say, well, how do you eat an elephant? And it's one bite at a time. And it's a marathon, not a sprint. But you have to really prioritize self-care, because otherwise it will just take you under. You will end up with health risks, both psychological, physical. You won't be able to be there for your family, for your partner. So that's really, really key. And taking it one day at a time. And also, I think being careful not to sort of run to make judgments and to, manage expectations. But one thing I have to say is that, and I say this in my book as well, what keeps me motivated is the hope that my couples bring to me. So they come to me, we work on these strategies, we have this session. And somehow they work it out and they come back to the next session. And I've had so many cases like that. There was one couple who went for 3 years in their marriage, I think, without being physically intimate. And that's a big problem in our community, in the community with these couples. So I was just thinking to myself, wow, is this ever going to change? Like I hope it was changed, because I could see like the little teeny tiny half baby steps, even, not even a full.
It's like the sparks of a fire, the little tiny embers.
Yeah, well said. And recently they went away on holiday and it happened, and they're in a whole different place. And already the relationship was moving and they were reading a lot of books and the trust was building, and his anger was dissipating. This is like 2 years of intense work.
Yeah, that's important to hear, because a lot of times we want instant results. So to hear that they committed to that 2 year process.
Yeah, and I think you have to gauge it that way, in years, not in days or weeks or months. And sometimes I have right now a couple in my practice where the woman is on the spectrum and the husband isn't, and she wants it to sort of get there already. And I use this marital satisfaction rating scale that's also in my book, and I use it in my practice, where I ask couples to rate from a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being perfect, everything is really happy in my marriage, and then 1 being, I'm going to call the divorce lawyer. and I ask them to rate each week. Sometimes that may be too much, but you know, when I feel like they need it, then I use it. And then I see it going up. And that's a great like meter to, you know, a great measurement of where are we going? Are we improving? Even if it's a half point, a quarter point, or are we going back lower? And I think that with the right ASD specific counseling for couples, specific ASD strategies, which is why I wrote my book, the traditional stuff doesn't work, and that 50-50 partnership type of thinking also doesn't tend to work, I think. So you just need a whole different paradigm, and then it can work, and you have to measure success within years. Some couples do run out of time. Unfortunately, I had a couple where they'd been to three other therapists. I think I was the third one or something like that, or fourth one maybe, the last one anyway. And they did decide to separate and split up, but I see less of that in my practice. I see more couples who stay together, unfortunately. So, but unfortunately for this couple, or but fortunately, I think they'll be happier, honestly, if they split up. Not everybody's meant to stay together, especially if you're so unhappy and it's affecting your health, you know, and your well-being as a human being. Like that shouldn't be. So when that happens, this couple did decide to move on, but they had tried for years. And I feel like both the ASPE partner and the partner, the non-spectrum partner, are so dedicated. It's beyond anything that I've seen. And I'm so inspired. So they give me hope, not the other way around.
Well, it's great to hear that that the majority of the couples that you work with are really committed, and regardless of how frustrated they are willing to hang in there and work through it.
Yeah.
So now if we can move to those on the autism spectrum in our audience who are feeling frustrated with their non-ASD partner, what would you say to some of them in terms of a hopeful word and maybe a specific tip?
I would say my specific tip would be to keep learning and keep growing and never give up. And I think a lot of people on the autism spectrum, they have that never give up spirit. That's why they're so good at winning Nobel Prizes or making discoveries.
David Finch is a great example of that. When I read his book, he just made a project of it, and he didn't let go until there were some major changes that he made.
Yeah. So A is never give up, because nothing can defeat a person who never gives up. And that's just a philosophical thing.
Right.
And it's true. It is true. And don't tell anybody, don't let anybody tell you, not even a therapist, that you can't do it or you're not going to get there. Because the truth is, even I don't know what somebody is capable of, because my own mind is limited. Because I'm a human being too. So I think just keep working hard. And I feel like, yes, the frustration may come from feeling like it's never good enough, that you work so hard and you feel like this Olympic, like, champion, you know, who's like really trying so hard, like these, making these massive efforts, and for such little return, it can feel that way. But I think that it is a neurological difference, and you're working with two different, you know, mindsets, and really try to understand your partner's point of view. You may not understand it viscerally or emotionally, but you can understand it intellectually and read about the non-spectrum partner's experience. There are a lot of books about this. You may still not get it, but still keep trying. Ask your wife. And your partner isn't out to get you. They're not trying to pin labels on you or paint you out to be a bad guy. They are suffering too, and they want really to be happy, you know, and really work on cultivating compassion for your partner.
Those are great words. And it strikes me that that's probably good advice for non-ASD family members too. So I think the words of hope and the tips can be traded back and forth between non-ASD and ASD. Would it be too much to ask you about ASD-ASD couples, where they both are on the spectrum?
I don't see that many of ASD, ASD couples.
Okay.
See, you know, they're sort of in the lower percentage, I would say. I do see ASD and other neurological differences. I right now have a couple where she has maybe a slightly above borderline IQ. His IQ is fine, above average. And she also has a learning difference and high anxiety. So, but, and maybe to the untrained eye, it can seem like she's on the spectrum too, but she's not. And I have neuropsychs for both of them, so it helps to see. And the ASD-ASD couples sometimes work out, you know, sometimes they work out actually maybe better than the non-spectrum and ASD because they have the same neurological stuff, you know, and I think that might work better. Doesn't mean that they still don't have issues. I right now have a couple like, I have actually one new couple like that, but they're not coming as a couple. That's why I didn't think of them right away. He's coming, one partner is coming, and the other partner might not have an official diagnosis, but I suspect that they're on the spectrum too. And he's coming more for the housekeeping stuff, sort of the clutter and the organizational piece. So you never know what's going to stump a relationship. It could be anything. It could be, you know, communication issues. It could be.
And that's for any marriage, right? Or any relationship.
For any marriage or relationship, yeah. And maybe I don't see spectrum marriages, maybe because they do work better, maybe, you know.
That's it. That's a good question. Sounds like a scientific study. Eva, what are the best ways for people to contact you and to find you on the web or on Twitter or Facebook?
Yeah, I think the best way to find me is on my website. So that way you can read about my work too. So you're acquainted with me maybe before you even contact me to learn a little bit about me. So my web address is evmendes.com. There's a contact form in there. There's also my phone number that you can contact me, and I respond as quickly as I can.
Great. So, and you mentioned that that your paper is on there, the 14.
Yeah, there are actually a bunch of papers on my website. Not just that, my thesis is also on there. There's a whole page actually called publications.
I see that. I'm going to post that, my readers and listeners, don't you worry.
Okay. So yeah, there's an article called Is It Time to Go See a Couples Counselor? There's the Woman's End of the Spectrum. Hopefully I'll have a couple more to go up there fairly soon. There's also something called Books and Movies About Asperger Syndrome, Marriage and AS in Woman. So a lot of good resources, and my paper on marriage is also translated into Spanish and, believe it or not, Polish.
That's so great.
And if anybody wants to translate my paper into more languages, please get in touch with me.
That sounds great. Well, you can bet I'm going to be picking up this book.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Eva. I really appreciate it. And I have a feeling we're going to be talking again for another episode, if you're willing.
Would love to.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thanks, Eva Mendes, for sharing your experience and relationship tips with us. Please check out her book, Marriage and Lasting Relationships with Asperger Syndrome. You can also learn more about her at evmendes.com. That is evmendes.com. By the way, I don't want you to miss a blog post or an episode. Please sign up for the Thrive with Asperger's newsletter. Go to myaspergers.net. At the top of the page is a bar in which you can enter your email address to subscribe so that I can stay in touch with you and keep you updated on my new blog posts and other news and tips. I'd also be so grateful to you if you'd rate my podcast on iTunes. This helps tremendously with keeping my podcast visible so that people who have never heard of it can discover it. If you've already done this, thank you so much. I'm very grateful. And before we leave, I want to leave you with an action step. Go to myaspergers.net/20. Look down to the links section and go to Eva's article, Marriage with Asperger's Syndrome, 14 Practical Strategies. Read through the article with your partner and pick one or two practical strategies you can focus on in your relationship. In the next episode, I'll be interviewing Anita Lesko and Abraham Nielsen, a Florida autistic couple who pulled off the first all-autism wedding this year. Until then, have a great 2 weeks.